Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, January 16, 2017. President Kiir creates more states in South Sudan.
Creation of states means creating more positions for public servants and so on. And that means the need for resources. I think the government best knows how it's going to maintain this huge number of states.
And the president fires the governor of the central bank over the weekend. Can this move improve the economy?
If the new management in the central bank and also in the Ministry of Finance is able to formulate a certain policy to restore confidence in the South Sudanese citizens and try to protect and maybe increase their purchasing power.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Reaction in Juba to President Kiir's decision to create more new states is mixed. Over the weekend, Mr. Kiir unilaterally created the new state of Northern Upper Nile, Central Upper Nile, Maiwut, and Tombora State. This after President Kiir created 28 states out of the original 10. Many civil society activists and residents think the government should concentrate more on restoring peace and improving security throughout the country rather than creating new states. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Rajab Mohandis, executive director for the local NGO South Sudan Network for Democracy and Elections, or SUNDE, says the decision to create more states will cost more money at a time when South Sudan's economy continues to implode.
Creation of states means creating more positions for public servants and so on, and that means the need for resources. So in terms of the situation we have now, I think the government best knows how it's going to maintain this huge number of states.
Needless to say, Mohandis adds that it will be a challenge to budget for the needs of all 32 states, given the current economic and political crisis. Others disagree. Clement Arcangelo Joseph, president of the Seventh-day Adventist Church in South Sudan, welcomes the decision to create more states, saying it will boost service delivery to the people of South Sudan.
If it helps to solve the problem of our problems, and if it helps to improve the way how we manage services to our people, I think he has done the right thing.
But Joseph agrees that the government's first priority should be to provide security and ensure that people are able to move freely across the country.
As a church, our main interest is really to see how our people live in peace, in unity, and so that they can prosper. So our priority focus is actually to see how we can also contribute towards a peaceful South Sudan.
Juba resident Lasu Ahmed opposes the decision, saying the government has failed to develop even the existing states and the capital of the country.
Even if we see the situation in Juba, our roads even are not tarmac, we should still first focus on these few states that have been created recently, and we develop them up, and we see what is the way forward.
The SPLM-IO faction, allied to former first vice president Riek Machar, has condemned Mr. Kiir's decision to increase the number of the states to 32. In a press release issued today, Mabior Garang, who heads the SPLM-IO National Committee for Information and Public Relations, says the decision to create more states without involving the citizens will lead to more conflict, including border disputes between communities. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
And the president also issued another decree over the weekend, firing the governor of the central bank and his deputy. Juba-based SAD Institute analyst Abraham Awelich says the decision was long overdue, but other analysts say changing the management of the central bank will not fix the country's economic crisis. Tito Justin has more for VOA from Juba.
Over the weekend, President Kiir fired central bank governor Cornelio Koriom and his deputy John Dor, and in a separate decree, the president nominated Atom Ajak as the new central bank governor. Lual Achildeng, analyst and managing director of the Ebony Center for Strategic Studies in Juba, says replacing the central bank governor is normal and will have little effect on South Sudan's economic meltdown because of the ongoing security crisis in the country.
You have to ask about the high rate of inflation, the high depreciation of the pound, is because of high fiscal deficit, meaning government is spending more than what it receives in terms of revenues. Why is government spending more than what it receives? It's because government has been fighting a war. And fighting a war means more expenditure.
Deng says Southland's economy will stabilize only when the country achieves lasting peace through a comprehensive effort by all authorities. He says the Minister of Finance and the Central Bank should work together to address the country's economic problems after security is restored nationwide. Deng says the main focus should be on how to achieve peace in South Sudan.
It's not enough to restore macroeconomic stability, which is the duty of the team, of the economic team. You have to also look at the security sector. And then the security sector means you have to look at the peace agreement, implementation of peace agreement. The way it is being implemented, we hope it will now lead into stability.
Abraham Awolich, a police analyst at the Juba-based Sud Institute, says President Kiir's decision to sack the governor of the Bank of South Sudan is long overdue and sees it as an opportunity to improve the flow of currency in the country.
The last few years, it seems like the government has not been banking with the central bank, and so therefore the central bank is not in charge of the money, and therefore it cannot regulate money flow. That is long overdue. It has to be corrected. Number two, the interbank system has collapsed completely with regard to hard currency. So if I get a check from Buffalo Commercial Bank, for example, and I want to go cash it in equity, they cannot do it, simply because they cannot reconcile their books with the central bank.
He suggests the new central bank administration should enact laws that tightly control the flow of cash in the country.
If the new management in the central bank and also in the Ministry of Finance is able to formulate a certain policy to restore confidence in the South Sudanese citizens and try to protect and maybe increase their purchasing power, many good things will happen thereafter, including peace itself, because economic stability is the biggest part of peace. But when the economy is in tatters, even if the war technically stops, criminal activities will continue to rise.
South Sudan has depended on oil production for nearly 98% of its revenue. Several oil fields were either partially or fully shut down because of the ongoing conflict in the country. Economists have been warning for some time that South Sudan's economy was on the verge of collapse due largely on its heavy dependence on oil. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Sudan's Foreign Minister Ibrahim Ganduri says Khartoum will do more to cooperate with the United States following the U.S. announcement on Friday to ease certain sanctions imposed on the country. Nabil Biagio reports for VOA from Khartoum.
Foreign Affairs Minister Ghandour told reporters over the weekend in Arabic that the sanctions imposed in 1997 by the Clinton administration and tightened later in 2006 by the Bush administration were lifted because Sudan has been cooperating and will continue to cooperate with the U.S. on five tracks.
The first track is combating terrorism. The second track is fighting the Lord Resistance Army in the region. The third track is supporting peace in South Sudan. The fourth track is peace in Sudan, while the fifth track is facilitating humanitarian access to war-affected areas in Sudan. We discussed and negotiated these issues over with Americans.
Ghandour says Sudan has been engaged in talks since June with the U.S. State Department, the Pentagon, the CIA, U.S. Homeland Security, and the presidency.
We consider this a first step towards normalizing our relations with the United States government and the opening of investment for international companies to come and do business in Sudan. We are committed to what we both agreed upon, and we expect the new administration will honor our agreement and continue with the cooperation.
Randour says the easing of sanctions paves the way for normalizing relations between Sudan and the U.S. Khartoum-based political analyst Ismail Ibrahim says the decision to ease sanctions gives President Omar al-Bashir's government a chance to make things right.
I can just describe it as a golden opportunity or a golden window of hope, and that the government should lose no time, no energy, no whatever effort to seize this opportunity and to make the maximum benefit of it. And the most important thing that is to make genuine efforts and take the initiative to stop all the wars, whether in Darfur or in the Blue Nile and southern Kordofan.
Ibrahim says the government's actions caused the sanctions in the first place, and it is the government that has the power to change the way it is treated by other governments.
Because all of these problems, most of them, 99% of them, as a result of the mismanagement of our internal affairs. And that is the most important thing, to make a real breakthrough in terms of putting things into order and just go to the limit, you know, and push to the maximum limit in getting some sort of a national reconciliation.
Taxi driver Ahmed Omar says the lifting of sanctions was long overdue because they hurt innocent Sudanese citizens who have nothing to do with the government. Speaking in Arabic, Omar says, the Sudanese people are very peaceful people. I think God has delivered justice through the American decision to withdraw these sanctions. They should not have been imposed on us to begin with. We as a people are not terrorists and we do not support terrorism. Another Khartoum resident, Musa Hussein, says, while the decision itself is a positive one, the Sudanese people need to see results on the ground. Hussein says in Arabic, it's a good decision, of course, but I'm skeptical about its implementation unless the government changes its policies. And unless the market improves and things become cheaper, we will not benefit from this decision. Muhammad Ali is a currency trader in a Souq al-Arabi. He says the lifting of Sudan's sanctions will hopefully curb the high inflation in the market. Ali says in Arabic, as soon as we heard the decision on Friday, there was an immediate drop in the value of the US dollar against the Sudanese pound. But it is rising again now, so we are yet to see if the market will improve in a sustainable way. The easing of certain sanctions by the outgoing Obama administration went into effect immediately. In 6 months' time, if Sudan continues to cooperate with the U.S. in counterterrorism measures and other good behavior, other sanctions will be lifted. The easing of sanctions, however, do not include a pardon for President Omar al-Bashir, who faces charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity for the government's aerial bombardments of civilians in Darfur and other activities. Randour is also urging the U.S. administration to take Sudan off its list of state sponsors of terrorism. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, has the regional bloc IGAD failed to bring peace in South Sudan? We'll bring an answer to that question when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today.
What important life-saving technique do you know?
I was once a member of Red Cross, so I was trained to give first aid, for example, to a baby who is choking, you get? Then to give first aid to someone who has had a fractured dislocation. Yeah, that's all.
Self-defense. It is a life-saving technique because the city where we are now has lots of thugs everywhere. And if you have that self-defense, it really, at least they may take what they want from you, but it saves your life.
When someone has run into a water, let me say, was swimming, you pull him or her up from the water, and then you pump the water out, and you give him oxygen with a kiss of life.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new media report says the United Kingdom and Norway are sponsoring fresh talks in Doha to find a solution to the crisis in South Sudan. James Joner, a former United Nations Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, spoke to VOA's Peter Clotty about the purpose of the talks.
I have a bias in the sense that I believe African states have the capacity to resolve African questions by themselves. I think the issue in South Sudan is not lack of knowledge of what should be done. I think both the African Union and IGAD have done their best. The agreements are sound. The problem is that the parties are not willing to implement those agreements. So the question is, how do you get the parties to implement it?
So you don't think the UK and the Norway, part of the TRICA, and perhaps IGAD, that will not be a mediator this time, but just an observer, wouldn't be able to put pressure on these two main rivals in South Sudan to resolve their problem once and for all and save their people?
Well, you know, Peter, you know, throughout my career for 35 years, I've been a major negotiator of the United Nations. That developed a theory during the time of Kissinger that you have to have individuals or states that have the capacity to compensate people to implement agreements. Maybe from that point of view, the UK entry into it makes some sense. But frankly, it will not change the issue. What you have from IGAD and the African Union are the best you can do. The problem is that they don't want, they are refusing to implement it. And then we have another curious situation, which when the United States representative suggested that you can proceed without Salva Kiir, which doesn't make any sense to me.
You mean Riek Machar?
Riek Machar, yes, who is supposed to be under house arrest in South Africa. It doesn't make any sense. How can you solve the problem of South Sudan without Riek Machar? You don't have to agree with him. That's the reality of South Sudan.
President Salva Kiir has said that his first vice president, who he replaced Dr. Riek Machar with, Thabang Dengai, is working with him and they are trying to implement the peace process. You doubt that. Why?
No. Let me tell you, I've been involved with South Sudan since when I was in the UN. Before the peace agreement with the Sudan. I know these people enough. That's nonsense. You cannot deal with South Sudan problem trying to isolate Riek Machar. You cannot do it. I know these people. So it's a try to, I want to call a quick fix. It will not last. It will not last. And people have to come to that reality that you must bring all of the parties together. Look, at the heart of the problem of South Sudan is an ethnic problem, ethnic rivalry. So you don't do that by ignoring one major party.
So should we expect this crisis to continue?
No, I don't think it can continue. I think what the UK and the major powers could have done is to lend their strong support to implement the agreement which has been concluded between the parties in South Sudan.
But in this case, they categorically stated that Riek Machar should be part of this talks in order to come up with implement the agreement that has already been signed, which they think is the best way forward to address this problem. You tend to agree with that?
Yes, I agree. The problem, let us see what was the problem. You know, President Salva Kiir was very, very honest in saying he has reservation about the agreement. Okay, he went ahead, but with reservation. And then we have the problem of security. Okay, Riek Machar came to South Sudan. The disagreement. Why they felt that Riek Machar was planning to run for the presidency. You know in Africa what it means to run for the presidency. So there are, on both sides, maybe people who don't like each other.
That's James Noah, a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, speaking yesterday with VOA's Peter Clody from New York. A leader of the SPLM-IO Youth League says a recent gathering of South Sudanese youth in Nairobi was aimed at drumming up support for President Kiir's proposal for a national dialogue. Port Kang Chol argues the participants at the meeting are partisan and have endorsed President Kiir's leadership style.
I'm not pleased by the outcome of the meeting held in Nairobi. First of all, I would like to acknowledge that I was invited as an individual and I was not told of the agenda of the meeting. But because of some concern in Nairobi, I could not make it there.
Your fear for going to Nairobi is not really legitimate because there are lots of members of SPLM-IO who stay in Nairobi, very senior than you, and they have not been deported.
You know that there were a lot of people before the deportation of James Gaded, and up to now they are still there. But remember, James Gaded, who was also junior to all of them, was deported for one way or the other. Anyway, that is not the main issue. The main issue is that the outcomes of the meeting did not address the real concern of our citizens in the Republic of South Sudan.
What are these real concerns?
The main concern should be the resuscitation of the peace agreement. How do we resuscitate the peace agreement? Not replacement of the peace agreement. But if you look at the outcome of the meeting, it only endorsed the proposed national dialogue by President Kiir, who is also a party to the crisis, is a party to the violence. We put it clearly, and we said it over and over again, that it can only work, the peace agreement can only be resuscitated through a political dialogue outside the country.
This meeting was held in Nairobi, outside South Sudan, and you opted not to go because you were afraid of for your life.
Yes, I opted not to go, but I was not also given the opportunity to nominate somebody. I was not even asked, as IO, we were not even asked to send a delegation.
My understanding is that that was not a political meeting because some of my colleagues who attended the meeting don't belong to any party. They went there in their capacity as South Sudanese. So it was not a political meeting so that you can say you were not invited in your capacity as the SPLM-IO representative.
Yes, some of the members were not party members. That is true. I agree with you. But some of the members are party members. They are members of the SPLM. They were invited from Juba, and they participated in that meeting.
But they came there in their capacity. They came there in their capacity as South Sudanese. Can we put that clear, that people who attended the meeting went there because they are South Sudanese?
I know them as members of SPLM in the government, and they have been colleagues before the crisis. Some were even threatening that the deportation awaits me, and that, I'm just lucky that I did not go to Nairobi, and blah, blah, blah. So what I'm trying to say is that the outcome, John, did not address the real issues that are supposed to. In effect, it opted to support the position advanced by President Selfa.
Port Kang, try to help me here, because it looks like the youth in South Sudan, including you, have followed politicians blindly, and instead of ending the conflict, they are fueling the conflict. Would you agree with that analysis?
I don't agree with you.
Why?
Personally,
why?
I had the opportunity. Yes, let me explain why. I had the opportunity in 2014, 2015 to be part of the negotiation in Addis. And at my capacity as a young person who had the opportunity to participate there, my call was that we should and we must bring this war to an end because it is not benefiting any of us, especially the young people. They are the one dying day and night. And I'm not going to benefit out of their death. But then the peace agreement must be a genuine and a sustainable one, John. It should not be an agreement that only favors a section of the community or of the country and leave the rest to linger in the UNMISS camp. It should be an agreement that favors all of us as South Sudanese. It should be an agreement that protects all of us. It should be an agreement that benefits all of us in one way or the other.
That's Port Kang Chol, SPLM-IO youth leader. He was speaking to me earlier today from the village of Gwek on the border with Sudan. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day in America. It's a national holiday to honor a man most closely identified with the civil rights movement that ended racial segregation in the United States and helped to end discrimination in employment, education, housing, voting, and public service. VOA's Adam Phillips asked some of his fellow New Yorkers to offer their opinions of Martin Luther King Jr. and his legacy.
It's almost 5 p.m. and Flotantina Mariani, an African-American hospital technician, has just ended her shift. She's looking forward to the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. She says that almost 50 years after his death, King's legacy is still very much alive.
What he represents in my heart is that he had gotten a lot of black people together. He made a lot of inspiration of how we should feel proud about ourselves as people of color, and also as opportunities of what you could be. You use what he did by using his philosophies that you can overcome anything, even adversity on your job, in the street, you know, just interacting with people you can overcome. He makes me want to sing, and the song that I like singing is We Shall Overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday.
On the face of it, one might assume that Jake Berman, a privileged white 21-year-old who attends an Ivy League university, and Ms. Mariani have little in common. But Dr. King's legacy touches them both in similar ways.
Definitely a feeling that you can overcome something that seems pretty impossible, whether it be a small accomplishment or maybe even a bigger thing in school. If it's the bully or if it's the group you hate or anything like that, just being able to maybe just like rise above and do it in a humble, respectful manner that wasn't violent or rude, that is definitely a great feeling, and that's what he did.
78-year-old Victor Rotner, a white man, considers King to be a great humanitarian and a great American. King's courage continues to move him to this day.
He never backed down on anything, and he was never mean about anything. He had never put any white people down, and I believed everything he's done was worth it. We got so much from it, the black community, and so did the white community.
School is out, and Joy Beth and some other nannies are watching their charges in a Central Park playground. Born in Trinidad, Joy Beth is an American citizen today. She credits Martin Luther King Jr. with helping to make her good life possible.
He paved the way for people like me for equal rights. Hadn't he did what he did, maybe today we wouldn't be able to be sitting on the bus or even sitting by you right now. There'll be the park will be segregated. There'll be one side for the black, one side for the white. That's what I remember about him. He did something special.
Cheryl, another nanny, is also grateful that King lived.
I think he did an excellent job, and, you know, he had a dream, and his dream did came true because we had a black president.
Still, Cheryl is unsure whether her white employer will let her take the day off on the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday.
Usually, I don't like to work that day because I think we should honor his rights. And people who we work for, like white people, of course, they should make us honor that day. Respect that day because, you know, he lives in us. We should have that respect because he fights for black people.
White people too.
If they want to, you know, but it's more a black people thing, you know, because he was a black man fighting for black rights, you know. So if white people do it, it's a nice thing. That means that his dream is coming true. We are trying to reunite with one another, which is great.
Most Americans can agree that what Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights movement achieved is worthy of honoring with a national holiday. But it's also clear to many that the work for equality of opportunity and social justice continues. Faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase, said King, and we must learn to live together as brothers or perish together as fools. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
That's our show for this Monday. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.